don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on November 11th, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Texas political reporter Chris Hooks joins me and Nate for part one of our recap of the 2018 elections. All that and much more is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio this week is Nate. Hello, Nate.
Hey, Bill.
And not on this week are Rachel and Sarah. They're working on preparing some more of our upcoming post-election coverage over the next few weeks, including we're hoping to do an interview with the folks from the Medicaid campaign in Idaho, which just had a big victory. So they're busy working on preparing for that. But we do have, as a guest on this week, first time on the program, our buddy Chris Hooks, a political reporter from Texas. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. It's great to be here.
So, Chris, we have been hearing all year from you about all of the journeying around Texas you've been doing, following the various campaigns at different levels. Obviously, the big one that a lot of people are talking about was the U.S. Senate race, but you've certainly been paying a lot of attention to the other races, and a lot of your post-election coverage has kind of contextualized where the Senate race outcome fits in that broader picture. So we wanted to have you on to talk about that today. And I really didn't follow that race particularly closely. I think most of the information I was getting was reading articles that you were writing or just talking to you about what was going on. And, you know, I don't think I even ever saw a speech by O'Rourke, which, as I frankly do not have the patience for a cult of personality anymore. And it felt to me like that was a lot of what was happening. I don't want to color the discussion too much here, but I guess where do we start on this Texas discussion?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, as you say, like one of the interesting things about this this race for me was watching really about 6 months ago, maybe a little bit more than that, the discussion about this race bisected, and the race continued here in Texas, and then O'Rourke became like a national media personality, and that's obviously new for Texas. We don't have that level of national interest that often, but there was this kind of parallel campaign that was running at the national level where people were talking about Beto O'Rourke's viral videos and donating a lot of money. And I kept getting reports from friends of Beto O'Rourke signs up in Boston or Brooklyn or Berkeley.
Yeah, I saw some in Cambridge, so.
Yeah, that's amazing to me. And meanwhile, in Texas, the race was sort of continuing in a little bit in a way that I think much of the national media attention missed. And I'll say at the outset, I did not expect O'Rourke to win, not because I'm smart, but because I'm like generally pretty pessimistic about stuff in Texas. I've seen a couple of election cycles where there's been some hype or there's been some talk about doing something interesting at a national level, and then the Democrats severely underperform. I've come to understand that a lot of that is for sort of structural reasons to do with the state Democratic Party and how the sort of the Democratic coalition here operates that are difficult to repair and will take probably a long time to repair. And so I thought I was impressed with the campaign that O'Rourke was running, But I thought that he would probably underperform the polls a little bit. And I used to tell people I thought he would probably lose by 7 or 8 points. I think most Democrats in Texas expected him to lose. Towards the end of the race, there was maybe a little bit of hope that there was actually a chance. But most Democrats here, I think, did not expect him to win. The margin on election night in that race really shocked me. He came pretty close, 2.6 points, which is the smallest margin for a sort of a top of the ballot race in Texas since 1990. And I think I read somewhere the closest race in a Senate election since like the 50s. And what was even more shocking to me was that down the ballot, the results were pretty good for the Democrats, too. They didn't win anything statewide, obviously, as they haven't done since 1994. But there were some races on the statewide ballot that were quite close. The Attorney General Ken Paxton, a stalwart Tea Party Republican, who's also indicted, won. But he won by 3.6 points, I believe. Two of the other sort of most firebrand Tea Party Republicans in statewide office, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and Agricultural Commissioner Sid Miller, won by about 5 points. And obviously, if you're from a blue state or a purple state, even that doesn't sound very good. It sounds like a pretty devastating loss. But in Texas, it marks some positive movement for Democrats, which they have not seen in a long time. And I think that bisected national conversation about the Texas Senate race played out after the election as it did before, where a lot of people said, well, Beto O'Rourke lost, and this is the best that the Democrats can do this year, and they still lost, and none of their other candidates lost, and so we were right, and nothing interesting has happened in Texas, just as it never does. And then you had a lot of Democrats in Texas, I think, quite pleased and wondering what this means for 2020. And I think it's entirely possible that this is a one-off. Obviously, a lot of it depended on O'Rourke's strengths as a candidate. He was a very personable, charismatic guy, and it was easy for people in sort of the center and the left to invest in him because he was this kind of once-in-a-generation political figure. So if he doesn't run again, maybe the Democrats slip back. Maybe something happens in 2020 that makes this a less favorable political climate for Democrats. And if that's the case, this will be seen as a one-off. But I think that there's a significant chance that if the Democrats play their cards right and get some other help from circumstance, that this is something that they can build on. And no one is more surprised to say that than me.
Now, when you say 2020, I think you're talking about like the state races in 2020, like the U.S. Senate race against John Cornyn. Obviously, again, there's some bisecting there, as you said, between national and in-state discourse on that, because there's been some sort of weird 2020 presidential buzz for some reason around Beto O'Rourke. But talk a little bit about the Senate race, I guess, and just the 2020 sort of in general with regard to Texas.
Yeah, absolutely. So we don't have any more statewide elections apart from another Senate race until 2022. And that's actually not great for Democrats in a lot of ways, because if a Democrat wins in 2020, which I hope is the case and it seems significantly likely, don't want to jinx it, then the climate looks worse for Texas Democrats, because they need to be running in order to have a chance with an unpopular Republican in the White House. The last time they got significantly close to controlling the state chamber of the state legislature, for example, was 2008. They got a really big boost from Barack Obama and George W. Bush's unpopularity. So it's possible in 2 years Trump is less popular than he is now. Democrats turn out in significant numbers. And in Texas, what that means is the state legislative elections, which are hugely important, obviously, there's a number of districts that Texas Democrats have a chance to flip on top of what they won this year. So I believe that they had 55 seats in the state house, which has 150 seats. They brought that up this year to 67 seats, and there are 8 more seats that the Democrats lost by less than 5 points, some of them that they lost for like 0.3 or 0.5 points, and that are in areas that they've made a lot of progress over the last couple of years. And if they win those seats in a year with a very favorable Democratic electorate, that would bring the state house to 75-75, which would be extraordinary. There's a couple of state senate seats that they have a chance to pick up. They also, while doing pretty well in the in congressional races in Texas this year, they picked up two seats and may have picked up a third. It's headed to a recount. There are five more congressional districts that the Democrats lost by less than 5 points. And the Democrats did not put resources into many of these races, understandably, because they were not seen as likely pickups. The fact that they were close this year, I think, is a message to donors in the state and the National Democratic Party, for whatever degree that they can help, they don't always, is a message that there's places in Texas to put money and to put effort and have it returned, which is what Democrats have been waiting for a long time. At the top of the ballot, you have a Senate race against John Cornyn in 2020, and a lot of Democrats here, I think, are hoping that that Beto O'Rourke will stand and run for that. John Cornyn is one of the least popular Republicans in statewide office in Texas. He's been around for a long time. He doesn't elicit the same degree of hate that Ted Cruz does, but he also doesn't have the same fan base that Ted Cruz does. I think Beto O'Rourke has a meaningful chance in that race. Of course, there are a lot of people, Democrats being Democrats, that are desirous that he run for president in 2020, which is absolutely baffling to me because there are going to be countless Democrats running in 2020. It's not clear to me that Beto O'Rourke has a more meaningful chance than any of those people. And Texas is where the place where he can evidently do some good in the immediate future. I very much hope that he doesn't run for president in 2020, but the hype machine has kept going, so we'll see.
Yeah, I've already seen polls with him like polling double digits or like high singles, like ahead of a lot of the other most talked about people. So,
oh, good,
great.
So you mentioned kind of that, you know, he was a once in a generation figure for Texas politics, or Texas Democratic politics at least, and that he was this charismatic figure. I'm guessing, I'm thinking, you know, maybe we should talk a little bit about, you know, how does he compare to the sort of the rest of the landscape there? You know, you were covering the governor's race there as well this year, which was sort of not much of anything. You know, we talked on this show 4 years ago about sort of the giant belly flop of the governor's race 4 years ago. And that, I think, was another one where one of the big themes that I picked up on was this sort of huge divergence in how it was being handled in state versus this sort of national parallel race. And Wendy Davis, I think, was getting a lot of money from out of state that was then causing problems in state, which I think, you know, they tried to do with O'Rourke as well, but maybe less successfully. Can you sort of lay out where he kind of fits in the landscape politically as a person, whatever, as a candidate?
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe a little overemphasized now for the sake of the narrative, but when Beto O'Rourke started running, people were just not very familiar with him in Texas, partly because he was from El Paso, which is an 8 or 9 hour drive away from Austin, and it, for a lot of Texans, is in sort of a different state. I think people that knew O'Rourke knew that he had some serious political talent, personal charisma and all that. But he just wasn't on the radar of a lot of people in the Texas Democratic Party. And he sort of swooped in from nowhere and saved the party this year, at least, because they did not have anyone else in the party who wanted to commit to a statewide race, which in hindsight is a little strange because this looked like a year in which Democrats were going to do better than they usually do. But the people who are the sort of the frontline Democrats in the legislature, some of them toyed around with running for attorney general or something like that, but none of them decided to. The sort of the top tier talent, which for now includes the Castro brothers, Joaquin and Julian, decided not to run for governor after some talk of that. That's one of the reasons, I think, for optimism about how Texas Democrats did this year is there was essentially no one else who counted as a strong frontline Democrat on the statewide ballot. The Dallas County Sheriff Lupe Valdez, who pronounces her name Lupe, stood up to run for governor, and that campaign was sort of a sacrificial lamb against the very well-funded incoming governor, Greg Abbott. A lot of the other people on the ballot you could describe as strong individuals but were not people who had a lot of experience with politics or support from anybody. I think that there's a chance that this the strong performance from the O'Rourke campaign and the strong performance for Democrats up and down the ballot encourages some of those frontline Democrats in the legislature and maybe others to consider statewide races next time, depending on the climate, or to stand up and run for state Senate in a couple of districts that have a chance of being swung in 2020 or for Congress. And that also brings back to the party people who want to run for office and people who want to make politics their career and the consultants and people like that. Who for a long time have seen Democratic politics here as a dead end or sort of a charitable endeavor, I guess.
Yeah, you sort of mentioned that in the Atlantic article recently where, you know, you talk about a lot of talented Democrats in the legislature quitting, thinking there was no future, or like the young sort of like party professionals who do the campaign work, a lot of them moved or, you know, went to D.C. or something like that. So they might have a reason to stick around now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think briefly there's sort of two issues facing Democrats, Texas Democrats, have been for a long time. There's this sort of the numbers question where you sit down and you find a winning coalition, and you go out and register those people and get them to vote. And then there's sort of the psychological problem, which for 20 or 25 years, the party has been a losing cause. And that causes the people who support the party in good circumstances to turn away. If you're a donor in Texas, and there are a lot of rich Democrats here, you donate to national causes instead of local ones. If you are a bright young consultant or a political strategist, you go and work somewhere where you can lead a fulfilling life and make some money and do some good. And if you're a member of the community with a strong reputation, you might run for office in other states. It's the Texas legislature maybe doesn't look that good to you. If you're in the legislature, maybe you get out and find a job in some other sector. I mean, it's just up and down the list. It's sort of that's the psychological problem. And I think the hope is that a proof of concept or one or two cycles in which the party does pretty well brings some measure of those people back to the state and rebuilds a substantial portion of the Democratic Party in short order. Of course, it's not going to be easy. There's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, there was a line here that I liked. Working for the party here became a kind of social work, a charitable endeavor performed at personal cost by people with a high tolerance for pain, and lessening that pain might be key there. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it sounds like despite the Senate loss, although, you know, not a big surprise to any of us, it was a good night for the Texas Democrats and maybe better than expected in a lot of ways and promising for the future, potentially at least. Let's talk about some of the national landscape and some of the other states. Obviously, there's a few of them that we're not going to get too far into, like Florida and Georgia, because those are still up in the air in terms of the big statewide races. But there were obviously some big victories, like, you know, the Kansas governorship for the Democrats, and same thing in Wisconsin and Maine. As we said, we'll be talking on a future episode about the Medicaid victories that happened in several states. We did want to talk about a few of the referendum questions of note in certain states. Nate, you were going to talk about some of those. I guess we'll start off with the big one in Florida, although we still don't know what the outcome of the Senate and governor's races are there. Things might have been different if this amendment that passed there had been in place earlier.
Right. So an estimated 1.5 million people in Florida who have completed their felony sentences, but they can't vote currently because of law, they could be re-enfranchised. I think that passed about 60%. So that's a fairly encouraging sign. There were some other criminal justice measures. In Ohio, they rejected a measure at reducing the prison population by decreasing penalties on low-level drug crime. So that failed. But in Colorado, they outlawed involuntary servitude as a punishment. And in Louisiana, voters said juries in their felony trials must be unanimous in their verdicts, which was a Jim Crow era law that where you, if basically 10 people agreed, they could just convict you anyway. So
to override the black jurors, essentially.
Exactly. And so there was a bunch of other stuff, Bill, you wanted to mention that a bunch of these environmental initiatives failed, including a carbon tax in Washington State. and a similar one in Arizona.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think we talked about last election cycle that there was this sort of controversial referendum in Washington State dealing with a carbon tax, and a lot of the environmental groups opposed it because it was not very well thought out, and it was just sort of like they hadn't done the coalition work necessary to get it done, so it was sort of went down in flames, and probably rightly so. And then they tried to come back, I think, this year and do a better version of it, and that also went down. Enormous amount of fossil fuel money being poured into those races, and you mentioned about the fracking
in Colorado that failed. Also, the LA public banking, Measure B, also failed.
That was one that we had talked about on the show on our municipal public banking episode.
And then another big one was Proposition 10 in California for rent control. And a lot of money was poured into that, especially by Blackstone and other realty groups. So that lost. And actually recently, I think the offices of like the San Diego group that was working pro Prop 10, like there was a fire there, and it seems like someone did some arson.
Seems like pretty definitely arson, considering they lit the t-shirts on fire on the lawn
but,
before
burning
down the building.
But, I mean, they won, too. Yeah. So it's like, this is just like making a point. It's like, don't mess with us, I guess. And they were outspent like 3-1 there. So also in Massachusetts, we've been following the races where it's for questions 1 and 3 specifically. Question 1 lost quite decisively, where 3 passed.
So question 1, that was the one about the nurses union, put that on the ballot to try to get safer ratios of nurses and patients, and the hospitals just spent an enormous amount of money on that. So it went down pretty badly. Question 3, that was affirming transgender civil rights. This is the first time that it's passed a statewide ballot referendum anywhere in the country. That one, the pro-trans side did not want to go to the ballot with that, but it was forced through by the people's veto section of the Constitution by the opposition side. So basically, the voters were given a choice to act in place of the governor, say yes or no to the existing legislation that was on the books for 2 years. And they said, yes, we'd like to keep that, which is a huge victory there. A lot of wonkiness with the Massachusetts race, as expected for a long time, where basically Elizabeth Warren, Democrat, reelected to the U.S. Senate by a healthy margin, bigger than I expected, actually. And Charlie Baker, the Republican governor, also reelected by an even larger margin. And a lot of communities, including where we are, voting yes to Warren and yes to Baker, which is frustrating to us as lefty partisans. Yeah, ticket splitting here, I guess, still in vogue. I think there's a lot of, as we try to talk about, there's a lot of sort of reputation of Massachusetts nationally that doesn't really necessarily hold up to scrutiny if you're looking closely at, you know, into the state's politics. Chris, did you have any comments on any of these various elections around the country that we've been talking about? I know you've been pretty buried in the Texas stuff all year, but I guess now's your opportunity to sort of take a step back and look at the big picture.
Well, I was going to add one thing, another Texas thing. I'll say a big theme, obviously, of elections referendums this cycle was the right to vote. In Harris County, which contains much of Houston, Harris County has a greater population than 25 states. It's enormous. The guy who runs elections there for the last 8 years, I believe, is a guy named Stan Stannard. He's a Tea Party guy. Is a guy with politics that are not great, not especially a fan of people voting, has been warning about George Soros coming to Harris County to take over for much of the last year. And he got blown out this time by a Democrat. So going forward, a county that has about 4,800,000 people is going to have someone in charge of their elections that actually wants to make it easy to vote.
It's good news, certainly.
Yeah. I think there were also a bunch of small tweaks to voting rights in a bunch of states. So Maryland voted to allow registration up to Election Day. And then I think, unfortunately, North Carolina and Arkansas added the photo ID request. But I think Michigan approved a plan to automatically register voters when they renew their driver's license unless they opt out. Also, Nevada did that.
Michigan,
too.
Also another place where there was a Democratic pickup for governor.
They legalized marijuana too as well.
Yeah, and we don't, you know, as I said, we can't talk too much about the Senate stuff yet because a lot of that's still up in the air. The count isn't finalized in Arizona yet, although it looks like a Democratic pickup there, which I wasn't necessarily expecting. I also was being pretty pessimistic on Nevada, as I always like to be pleasantly surprised when that does come through for the Democrats there. That ended up being a pickup as well. But there were a bunch of Democratic losses. We're obviously not even talking about the, you know, like O'Rourke or whatever. We're talking about the incumbent Democrats that lost, which it looks like maybe Florida, but again, still up in the air there. Lost in North Dakota, Missouri, Indiana. I think that a lot of Democrats are, well, not happy to have lost those seats, but also, like, nobody's really super surprised because Heitkamp and Donnelly and McCaskill, ideologically, you're not losing a whole lot. Like, even if they'd won the majority back, it's unclear that they would have necessarily been voting with the Democrats on anything. Somebody like Tester was, it looks like he got reelected in Montana and was a much more reliable vote with the Democrats, despite being in a tight spot a few times. Did you have any impressions about those incumbents that lost in terms of it seemed like a lot of them were running to the right of where like O'Rourke was, you know, in Texas, not to say that O'Rourke was like running a super lefty campaign. I think that was maybe overblown somewhat in national discussion, but like, it seemed like they were running pretty far to the right and I don't think that helped them.
O'Rourke's 2.6 margin was obviously closer than a lot of these sort of, a blue dog or conservative Democrats that were running in these states. The thing I can't make head or tail of is what kind of deal with the devil Joe Manchin must have signed to have secured his seat once again in this climate in which all of his sort of ideological cohorts lost. I don't know.
Well, I guess we'll have Paul Blessed on probably in a couple weeks, and he can fill us in on all the West Virginia stuff because he did a lot of reporting on that this year, and specifically sort of learning the lore of Joe Manchin. But yeah, no, I mean, yeah, Manchin certainly kind of the exception there. I guess it could have been a lot worse for the Democrats, which is not a particularly high bar, but like, you know, there was a bit of time there where it looked like they might lose the New Jersey Senate seat. And the fact that you had a point where people were counting on we just need to win in like Nevada, Arizona, and Texas in order to offset our losses in New Jersey, like that, it could have gone a lot worse. Anyone's really happy that Bob Menendez is going back to the Senate because that dude is awful and should be gone as well, and he's super corrupt, yep, allegedly. But I guess it's better to have the seat than not have the seat. All right. Well, that's going to bring us to the end of our time today. Chris, you know, thank you so much for being on the show this week to talk about what you've been reporting on all year. And also thanks, you know, again, for providing all of our stuff for our Texas episode a couple months ago as well.
Oh, yeah. Happy to help, guys. It was great to be here. Thanks.
And Nate, thanks for being here in studio.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Chris.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.